Thanks, buddy. Thanks a lot.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm privileged to be here, and I appreciate being given the opportunity to do some service. I haven't found necessary to have a drink since January 17, 1981, and I can't take too much credit for that. I give all my credit to God and to a lot of people that went before me, my mentors. I'm going to talk a little bit about them. I want to read a few things in the book. Tonight, officially, this is a fifth step meeting. That's so you can keep count. I wouldn't get your expectations up. You know, you might be disappointed. Well, the truth of the matter is, after a little over 30 years of being in here, I'm convinced. I'm convinced, and I don't know how this works. I don't know how most of this stuff works. It's all a mystery to me, but I am, you know, after 30 years, you get a little inkling here, a little inkling there, and a couple of things that you might be sure of, but I am convinced that what you get out of this, whatever you get out of this, is going to be less dependent upon what I say and more dependent upon what's going on with you. And for some people, this is going to be a fifth step meeting, and it's going to be as clear as a bell, a fifth step meeting. Some people, it's going to be a first step meeting. For some people, it's going to be a 10th step meeting. Some people, it's going to be a 9th step meeting. Some people are not going to be able to pin any step on it. It's just going to be a good meeting. And some people aren't going to understand it at all. And some people will say, I can't believe that guy. I've never heard so much horse shit in my life. And that's okay. You know, it's A is a giant toolbox. There's a wrench to fit every nut that walks through the door. And I might be a wrench tonight, and maybe I won't be. But, you know, all it says, I got to try to carry the message, which means I'm not even responsible for carrying the messages. I'm not responsible for carrying the message. All I got to do is try, and I'm going to do the best job I can tonight. Probably be the lousiest meeting I've ever done in my life, but it's going to be the best meeting I can do tonight at the Little River Club. So that's all I'm going to do. And I actually have a theme that I want to talk about tonight, and I'm not going to come right out and say it. You'll probably guess what it is, or maybe not. I don't really, when I first started doing the steps like 27 years ago, speaking about them and everything, you know, your story changes, things change. I've gotten older. I don't walk so well anymore. You know, a lot of things have changed. I've gained a little weight in the last 27, 30 years. And I used to, it says you can't give away what you don't have. And, you know, when I came in, I didn't have much. What I have is about 30 years of experience now. And prior to that, I have about 30 years of experience trying to do it a different way. And so what I try to share is my experience, what I've learned through watching other people and having this thing work in my life. And it says on page 29 of the big book, it says, further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recover. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories, and our stories are maybe the most important things we have. It says our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what we are right now. Where would we be if people weren't telling their stories? If you didn't have people up here who were telling you stories that you didn't say, listen, this stuff may all be a bunch of crap, but I believe that guy. There's just something about that guy. I believe him. You know, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, which was one of the books that was fundamental that the, in Dr. Bob of the Good Old Times, it's fundamental, one of the books, the three books that they thought were absolutely essential was 1 Corinthians 13, which I spoke about, I think, last week. The book of James, our organization was almost called the James Club, and the Sermon on the Mount, which is in New Testament, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. At the very end of the book of James, after Jesus gives the only sermon that's basically in the Bible, in the New Testament, the last paragraph is that it says this. It says, and the people were amazed because he spoke with authority, not like the scribes. It was just something the way he talked about himself and the way he talked about life that you knew it was coming from his heart. It was just an anointed type of thing. And I think what happens is people come up here, and we're all used to, you know, the way we talk to people in bars and the way we talk to people at cocktail parties and the way we talk to people on the outside. But there's something about the way people talk when they're working this program and they're talking about themselves up here, but you just know it's the truth. And, you know, you can argue your opinion about me and things, but you can't argue against experience and the truth. And, you know, for some of us, we just know it's like a tuning fork. We just know because of our own personal lives, people are telling us our things that we know are true because the exact same feelings and things happened in our life. And so that's why our stories are so important. It says right here, it says each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And what I pray is that every time I do a meeting, at least I do that deal. I may not much do of anything else, but I hope, like in my own personal story, through my own point of view, my own personal language, I describe how this thing is working for me, how I found my relationship with God, and how it's worked for me on a day-to-day basis. And whether or not you get something out of it, whether you like it, whether you, it's not really up to me. It's not really my deal. I'm not the AA police. I'm not here to enforce you. You don't have to believe I could be wrong for you. I might not be the guy for you. Maybe it's somebody else. You know, this is just what happened to me. You know, I think the worst thing, one of the worst things in the world is fear. Now, fear is a funny thing because most people that are in fear don't realize they're in fear. Because I knew I was in fear for years. For years I was in fear. I didn't know what fear was before I took the... You know what I thought fear was? When I was a kid, we used to go to horror movies. I'll never forget the scariest movie I ever saw. I was like 10 years old. It was called The Horror of Dracula with Christopher Lee. And me and two of my buddies went to see this movie. And we walked into this movie and the lights went out. And the first 5 minutes, Christopher Lee jumps out, you know, like jumps out of the closet with his fangs dripping blood. And we freaked out and we ran out of the movie theater. It's like the first 5 minutes. You know, I watched that thing a few years ago and it was like a joke. You know, Rocky Horror Picture Store. But you know, when you're 10 years old and Christopher really jumps out with fangs at the old Playhouse movie theater in Great Neck, New York, you know what I mean? We freaked out and ran down the street. And I'll never forget that. You know what that was to me? That was fear. And if you had asked me, up until the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 31 years old, at any time in my life, in my adult life, if you had even said to me, you're scared, I would have said, you're full of crap. I'm not scared of anything. I'm not scared of it. And listen to this, and believed it. One of the things it says in the book, it says selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the basic problem we have. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, which means we delude ourselves, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate. Later on in the book where they talk about, we list in our fears, it says, fear is the corrosive thread that runs through our lives. It says that our lives are just chock full of fear. And yet, for 31 years before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, if you asked me whether I was scared, I'd say, I'm not scared of anything. I'm not scared of anything. And then I'd sit in a bar and drink and talk about how I was worried about my job. I talk about how I was worried about a case. I talk about how I was worried about my girlfriend. I talk about how I was worried about money. I talk about how I was worried about you and worried about me and worried about everything. And then when I'd wake up in the morning, I'd worry about this. And then during the day, I'd worry about that. And I'd go to sleep at night worrying about this and thinking about that and thinking about this. And do they like me? And what do I say? And what is it going to have? And I'd be planning. And most of my plan was planning how not to get hurt because I was... Well, not scared. I was just, you know, I was just concerned. Because I'm not scared of anything. I'm not scared of anything. And I didn't know that almost every decision I made in my life was colored by, if not manufactured by and resulted from, absolute, stark, raving fear. Because you know something? Concern is fear. Oh, no, that's not fear. That's just concern. Concern is fear. Anxiety is fear. Worry is fear. And I was afraid afraid I wouldn't measure up, afraid I wouldn't make it, afraid they'd laugh at me, afraid they were talking about me behind my back. I used to sit, dying to go to the bathroom, at a barroom table, and I wouldn't leave the table because I was scared if I left the table they'd talk about me behind my back. So my way of stopping them from talking about me behind my back was to sit there and suffer. Sure, you're laughing. You never did that, but I mean, This is the kind of stuff that ran my life. Fear is horrible. Living a life, you know, I feel like living a life in fear is like being the walking dead. You just can't experience life when you're scared all the time. You wake up in the morning, you put these budgets in your mind, how much money you're going to make, how much money you're going to spend. An hour later, you're doing the budget thing again. 3 hours later, you're doing the budget thing again. The budget never changes. You kill off Uncle Ralph. You win the lottery. That's never going to happen. You don't even have an Uncle Ralph, but you think about it anyway. It's all fear, 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 fear. And then maybe you'll have a nanosecond where you're not scared, and then you start worrying about the fact that you're not scared. You start worrying about whether you're having a good, that you're having a good time and everything's okay, and you start worrying about maybe you're missing something or what's going to happen when things go bad. Don't even allow yourself a second without worrying about fear. Fear is just absolutely horrible, and you can't get, it's worse than boo. You can't get away from it. You know, every once in a while, I would put something in me that would get me to that point where I would get to that spot, that place where I really wasn't, where I really didn't care what they thought about me. You know, in your whole life, all you do is think about, what will they say about me? What are they thinking about me? What's going to happen to me? And you can put something in your mouth and in your body where you actually get to the point where you really, for a nanosecond, don't give a crap what anybody thinks about you. That's an incredible thing. And you're telling me that stuff, the only stuff that did that to me, that's the problem? That's the only reason I didn't blow my brains out before I was 25 years old. I'm an alcoholic because no woman, no amount of money, no suit of clothes ever worked just as well for me as a few drinks. And what the drinks did for me was it removed the fear. And when it says alcoholic are men and women who like the effect produced by alcohol, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. What they're talking about is, when they talk about ease and comfort, they're talking about something that takes away the fear. So I could drink and I could ask a girl to dance because I wasn't scared of whether she'd laugh at me. I could drink and then I could dance because I wasn't scared about what they thought about me or what I looked like. I could drink and I could mix with people in a bar and think that I'm like a sociable guy and I'm like a bar drinker. But the fact of the matter is, if I wasn't drinking, I couldn't mix with those people because it dispelled the fear I had, you know, my self-centered fear of what do they think about me. I could drink and be funny. I could drink and have a good time. I could drink and talk. I could drink and do anything. Because what stood in my way was the fear. Was the fear. Have you ever been humiliated in front of people? Has anybody ever been embarrassed in front of people? You ever worry about what people think about you? No, before or after, during coming in, you ever think about something like this? What are they thinking about? You ever think that people are talking about you behind your back? You ever think that people are laughing about you behind your back? Let me ask them, what would you do? What would you do to avoid being humiliated in front of people? Would you lie? Would you say you were making more money than you're actually making to impress them so they wouldn't laugh at you? Would you lie about yourself? You know, would you not tell them the truth? Would you lie about the truth and cover up things that were going on in you and make believe that you were somebody you weren't just so they would like you? What would you do if you found out that people were talking about you and found out stuff about you that was true but was embarrassing? Would you lie about it to them? Would you get mad? Would you avoid going to the party? Would you avoid people? If you thought people were laughing at you or knew something about you, would you change your life around? Would you not go to the party? Would you cut off friendships? Would you not pick up the phone? Would you not open up the letters? How far would you change your life? What would you do to avoid the pain of humiliation? What would you do? Would you stop talking to people? Even in your own family, would you not show up to weddings or not call it just to avoid the possibility that you might be embarrassed in front of other people or other people might laugh at you? How many times has that happened to you in your life? How many times in your life has your life been ruined? Have you gone places or not gone places, talked to people, not talked to people? Because you're worried about what they're thinking about you. How many times in your life, in dealing with your life and how you deal with other people, have you picked up the phone or not picked up the phone, or applied for a job and not applied for a job, or, you know, missed an appointment or not gone someplace because you were worried about whether people would laugh at you or stuff like that? How many times has that happened to you? How many times have you walked away from a meeting or something like that telling yourself you're an asshole? Hating yourself. How many times has that happened to you? One time? 20 times? 100? 1,000 times? 10,000 times? You know? How much of your life has to do with fear? 10%? 1 out of 10 thoughts? 2 out of 10 thoughts? 5 out of 10 thoughts? 9 out of 10 thoughts? About 90% of the stuff? It's about worry and fear? What would your life be? What are you, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old? What, have you spent about 80% of your waking hours being scared and not even knowing about it? You think that affects your judgment? Think that affects your relationships with people? Think it affects marriages? Think it affects your ability to be honest with people? You think it affects your happiness? You know, a lot of people say, well, I'm not happy. I don't understand. I don't feel good. You think it affects whether you're restless, irritable, and discontented? What do you think your life would be like if you could genuinely get rid of fear? We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Fear of people and of economic insecurity would leave you. What if that could happen like that and it was going for you like that for the last 30, 40 years? Do you think your life would have been different? Yes. Think you'd do things that you haven't done? How many things have you avoided doing because you're scared? A guy came up to me, tapped me on the shoulder. He says, you ever been to a Bible study? I said, no. He says, well, you ought to come to this thing. A bunch of guys you really like. And I said, And you know, the first thing I thought about was one of my aunts who had been dead for 10 years and what she'd think about me if I went. You're laughing because you think that's crazy. And it is crazy. And it's not a laughing matter. Because you guys do the same thing. You know, everything you do is with a thought in your mind, what will other people think about me? You go through your entire life thinking you're living your life, and you're living the life of some person who's playing to some imaginary group of people who you think are actually thinking about you when all they're doing is thinking about yourself, themselves. I spend more money that I didn't have charging on a charge card, buying things that I didn't need to impress people I didn't even like. And so did you. Every time you traded in a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or a car that worked good to get a newer car, the only reason you did that was to impress somebody else. Or to phony up and let somebody know that you're as good as or better than. Every time you traded in a car that was paid for or a car that was running to get a newer car, it was just so that you would be better in somebody else's eyes because you worried about what you would look like. Every time you worried about losing your car because it was going to be repossessed or something like that, or losing a house or losing something, I guarantee you 90% of stuff in your mind was not where you were going to live, because you know you're going to live somewhere. It's what will people think when they find out you lose that thing? What will people think when they find out you're unemployed? What will people think of you every time you lied to somebody about anything, or bragged about anything, or didn't tell the truth about anything? And you said to yourself, why did I say that? Why did I say that? It was all because you were worried and you were scared that they wouldn't like you and wouldn't accept you. And that's your entire life. That's your whole life. And that comes from somewhere. That comes from somewhere. Now you can, like, if you see a guy on the other end of the street that you either owe money to, or you were embarrassed by, or a girl or something like that, and you're embarrassed and you don't want to run into him because you can't look him in the eye, and you walk to the other side of the street, and you turn around and you say, I hope he doesn't see me. You walk to the other side of the street. That's out of fear. That's all about fear. And as you walk away from him, and he doesn't see you, or you think he doesn't see you, and you breathe a sigh of relief, and you go like this and say, man, thank God he didn't see me. And you walk away, and you forget about that incident. And 3 days go by, or 5 days go by, or 10 years go by, and you never see him again. And so you dodge that bullet. And you think, because you're distracted and you're messing around with other people and things, that you dodged that bullet. But you see, the place where that fear came from initially the thing that was inside of you, the piece that was missing, you know, the chink in your soul, which was so grave that you couldn't even look a man in the eye and had to avoid going, that thing, even though you walked away and he walked away, that thing is still there. And it'll be there the day you die. And what you don't realize, it's affecting you every second of the day. Whether you run into him or not, you still got that damage. You still got that thing going on. And you want to know something? If he walks into the room tomorrow, it's going to pop up again. It doesn't go away. And that's whether you're drinking or you're not drinking. Unless that's taken care of. And that's what's going on in your life if you're an alcoholic. That's your deal. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereinafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father and we are his children. Now, here you go. Listen to this. This has to do with the part where it talks about getting rid of self-centeredness and selfishness, which also has to do with fear, self-centered fear. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. He says, God makes that possible. God makes that possible. This book is consistent from step 1 to step 11 and 12, where it's all about God and getting closer to him, because he will do for you that which you can't do for yourself. So in the promises, at the very end where it says, we finally see that he is doing for us that we cannot do for ourselves, he's relieving this fear. This is true from the first chapter to the second, to the third, to the fourth, to the fifth, to the very end. I'm not going to tell you how to do step 5 because you can read about it in the book. And you can go to your sponsor and talk about step 5. I'm going to talk about freedom from fear. I'm going to talk because if you want that freedom, this deal is available to you. This is part of that deal. And if you don't want this freedom, you ain't never going to do it anyway. Even if I charted it out for you. Even if I was your sponsor and I told you how to do it, you ain't going to do it. Because you don't want what we have. And you don't want what's available. You want your old life. You're spoiled for your old life. Just give me the money and the gal and I'll walk across the street. It's okay. It ain't no big deal. I'll deal with it. I'll manage my life. He is the principal, we are his children. He is the father, we are his children. Now here, listen to this, because this is going to pop up again. This is before the fourth step, before the third step. It says, most good ideas are simple. And this concept, giving it all up to God and getting close to him, is the keystone, the main deal, the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. It's the keystone of the arch which we pass through to freedom. Freedom from bondage. Freedom from fear. You know, if I was to put an archway right in the center of this room and said, here's the deal. Those who pass through that arch is going to be free of the self-centered fear, never to have it come back again. And those who don't, won't. How many people are going to pass through that arch? Because this is the archway to freedom. They paint it out for you in the book. This is the way to freedom. Freedom from bondage. Freedom from fear of people and other... Freedom from economic insecurity. This is the pathway. Now, what does this have to do with step 5? Let's read a little about step 5. First of all, I want to read about... This is on page... If you're following along in the book, you might want to get a book on page 70. This is right after step 4. This is the sentence at the end of step 4. In this book, you read again and again that faith, and they're talking about faith in God, not talking about faith in yourself or even faith in your sponsor. They say that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. God can remove from you whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. One of the things fear does is it blocks you off from the sunshine of the Spirit. Resentment and fear blocks you from the sunshine of the Spirit. If you have already made a decision, that's the third step decision, and an inventory of your gross handicaps, that's the fourth step inventory, you have made a good beginning a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. And some of the chunks of truth about yourself are going to have to do with what I'm talking about now. The fear, the resentments, how these have played a part in your life. Then it goes on and stepped on in chapter 6 and into action, which is a chapter having to do, one of the things it starts with is the fifth step. It says, having made our personal inventory. So what do you think the fifth step is about? You think, you know, some people think it's like, they think it's about like group therapy. They think it's like going to a psychiatrist. We went to psychiatrists before we came here. It didn't work. They think it's about dumping. A lot of people think what AA is about. This is what they think AA is about. They don't think it has anything to do with God. You know what they think it's about? They think it's about therapy. Therapy. It's just some sort of form of therapy. This is what you do. You come into an AA meeting room, and you just vomit out on the table everything that's bothering you. And then you feel better and you walk away. And the next time you go, then you go out and some more things happen to you. You get pissed off and you go to an AA room and you walk in and you say, no, you got to listen to me. What happened to me? And you vomit on the table. What happened to you? And you feel a little bit better because you vomited over everybody. Maybe some people pat you on the back. And then you walk out and you say, man, I love AA. I love it. It's just like the bar. I used to do the same thing in the bar. I'd have a few drinks. I'd vomit on everybody. They weren't listening because they'd be vomiting on me. Your wife, you ought to hear about my wife. Your boss, you ought to hear about my boss. So what happens is, if you vomit for about 10 years, you know, you can vomit for the rest. You can stay here for 20, 30 years and just spend your whole life come to AA and complain about your problems and vomiting on the table. And you'll feel a little bit better because you get the vomit on the table. You actually think you're under the delusion that people actually want to listen to your horseshit, you know? Because this ain't Well People's Anonymous. We have some people in here that really want to listen to you, you know? Because they can't get, they're waiting for you to take a breath so they can tell you about their problems, you know what I mean? You will hardly notice, you may hardly notice that there are one or two people in here that maybe have 10 or 15 or 20 years that never complain. They're sober. They're sober. They have wives, they have kids, they have grandkids. They pay their bills, they come in, they come out, they sponsor people. You might notice that some of these people sponsor a lot of people. That people are always going up to these people and asking them to sponsor them. You know, because they must want what they have. And you might notice that there are actually people in here that aren't vomiting all the time. You know? You don't want to hang around them. They're like big book thumpers and, you know, they're boring and, you know, they're like adults. They're no fun. You know, they're self-righteous, you know. They're into that. They're all into themselves. It's all about them, you know. You might notice that that kind of stuff is actually going around, that people are actually coming in here and changing. They're not looking at their little plans, their little schemes, their little designs. They're more interested in other people. And so you might start realizing when you start getting into the book, if they get you in the book, that the fifth step isn't about vomiting at all. It's not about dumping at all. It's not about therapy at all. It's just another thing we do in order to get closer to Him so we can have a better relationship with Him so we can allow His power to come in. And you might actually read in chapter 6, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put a finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, the exact nature of our defects. So we come to see that what the fifth step is just one more exercise, spiritual exercise we do to get closer to Him and have a more solid relationship with God. And that's what every one of these steps is about. That's what it's all about. To do these steps with that concept, the idea of God or faith in God, is to bake the chocolate cake, leaving out the chocolate. It's to put in all the ingredients of the chocolate cake, leaving out the chocolate, and wondering how come it doesn't taste chocolatey. And what is that deal? What is that? How does that affect us? How would that affect us? It says on page 68, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. See, some of you think we're in the world to, you know, gather up as much money as possible. Or you think we're in the world to, you know, I've sponsored a lot of people. And it's not, I'm not like bragging, I'm just, when you've been around for 30 years and you're out there doing it, you know, and you know, really it's not ability. For, you know, in this deal, it's not ability. You got a lot of people with ability that can't stop drinking. It's availability. What God's interested in is availability, believe me. I remember going up to a guy and I asked him whether he had his number. I said, he's in the book. He says, I'm available. It's about, are you available? There's a lot of people that are not available for God. They're just not available because they're too busy earning money. They're too busy with their business. They're too busy on a lot of other things. They're too busy on things that are important to them, but have nothing to do with God. You know, one of the things that people, I think, I wondered why even myself, there's such a spiritual stuff and the steps and the Bible, because I read the Bible, I can have such a, in one sense, a love-hate relationship. Why do people hate the idea of the Bible? Why do people hate the idea of religious things? Why do people, and one of the reasons I came up with in my life is because the interesting concept about the spiritual life. You know how people say I'm spiritual, I'm not religious. One of the concepts that I've learned about the spiritual life is many of the rules of the laws that you learn here that are spiritual are completely opposite of the rules and laws of the material world. I mean, the material world, more is better. In the spiritual world, sometimes less is better. In the material world, you've got to control and defend. In the spiritual world, you let go and let God. I mean, it's like almost everything you're told in here for spiritual success is the absolute opposite of what you're told out there for material success. And it's scary when you live your whole life trying to play the game and to win what you think is going to make you happy. And you come in here and you're being fed an idea that your priorities are so mixed, all messed up, and you've got to somehow change your thinking, that so it's completely opposite of the thinking in many respects as it is out there. It's scary because you really have to make a choice between God and mammon, who you're going to serve. And I have friends and I have people I sponsor in here that make a lot of money. A lot of money. They don't even have to work anymore. They don't have to work anymore. They don't have to. I have to work for a living. They don't have to work anymore. And they're not even here tonight. They're not even enemy. You know why? Because they're working. You're laughing. You're laughing. They're working. They're not drinking. They're working. They're working because they got to work. They got to work because work is more important than this. And you know what they tell me? They tell me their life is all screwed up. And they don't know what the problem is. They don't know what the problem is. And I tell them the problem is your priorities. Your priorities. This is a program where you put the focus more and more on God, less and less on things, more and more on helping people, less and less on helping yourself. This is a program where when you finally get there to 11th step, you try to get even better at that. That's what it's about. And they say, I think you're right. And they say, next week, I'm coming to that meeting with you. And they call me up and they say, I can't make it because I got to go to work. Do you think I can help somebody like that? No, I can't. I can't help somebody like that. How can I help somebody like that? You know, I do a talk, and how many people have heard it, about the heart of the 10th leper. About when Jesus cured the 10 lepers and he said, go show yourself to the rabbi. I'm not going to go through the whole talk. And 9 left. It's a story in the Bible. And one came back and said, thank you, God. And the line, he says, but we're not 10 cures, and only one comes back to give glory to God. They asked Bill Wilson, what do you think of people who don't drink and don't go to meetings? He says, I have no use for them because they have no gratitude. Do you think there are people in AA that get sober, come in here because they can't stop drinking? and they'll do anything to stop drinking, and they stop drinking. And do you think there are people that come to AA and stop drinking, and AA helps them, and never sponsor anybody, and then go out there and just look for a gal, or look for a guy, or look for a car, or look for a job, and spend their whole life looking for that stuff, never sponsor anybody, and maybe don't drink, and if they're feeling kind of queasy every once in a while, they hop into a meeting because they're not feeling well. Do you think there are people like that out there? About 90%. Like any other organization. About 90%. 9 out of 10. They're in here to get sober so they can get the stuff. So they can put their life together. So they can basically manage their own lives. They're not here to get closer to God, or, you know, to sponsor a lot of people, or to help others, or anything like that. Not that they're mean people or evil people or anything like that. It's just their focus is on other stuff. And they're going to resent you doing a meeting like this, or hearing a meeting like, what are you, holier than thou? You know, I'm not saying anybody has to necessarily do what I'm doing or anything like that, but I have met them. I have sponsored them. The people that every time I talk to them, all they want to talk about is their things. They want to talk to me about their job. They want to talk about their wife. They want to talk about their marriage. They want to talk about this. They want to talk about that. And I say, well, let me ask some. How many people you sponsor? And he says, well, I'm not sponsoring anybody, but what does that have to do with it? I said, well, maybe you're worried about yourself a lot because all you do is think about yourself because you got nobody else to think about. I mean, just a thought, somewhere in the book it says we lose, you know, it's just a thought, you know, I may be wrong about this stuff. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role He assigns. Just the extent that we do as we think He would have us, and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us, and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. Don't think you're going to match calamity with serenity if your main goal is to try to manage your own life, which, by the way, the book says what we're convinced about is we cannot manage our own life. Your main goal is to do the role that He assigns and to be concerned with Him. This thing, you know, I hate to say it. You know, I mean, I said, look, this is just my story. But, I mean, really, I'm quoting it. This is not my opinion. This is the storyline. This is the line. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. You may think Alcoholics Anonymous. What separates us from the Kiwanis Club or from any group, self-help group that sits around and talks is this book. Big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I know enough about alcoholics, and I know enough about myself, that if you don't want to go in this direction, you can make believe these words aren't here. You can tell me all sorts of things. You could say, well, these words don't really mean this, or, you know, we do our own story, and we could do this thing any way we want to. You know, black means white. It all depends what the definition of is. You know, I never had sex with that woman, you know, having a penis in somebody's mouth isn't really sex. It's, you know, I mean, I know intelligent human beings are capable of bullshitting themselves and others about anything. And I know that as they're bullshitting people about anything, there'll be at least 10% of people saying, hey, he's right. Because they want him to be right. Because they're doing it. You know what I mean? And I know you don't want this to say what it says, because if what I'm saying is true, then there are some people that are saying, well, then I might have to change, and I don't want to do that, so I've decided what Russell is saying is bullshit. So then I can do AA my way, which is fine. You do your own thing, and you get what you get. We never apologize for anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. We commence to outgrow fear at once. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Why do people not want to do the fifth step? You know, they say, well, why do I have to talk to another people? I'll talk to God. Well, if you can't talk to another person, you can't tell it to God. I believe that. And I can't explain it to you. Maybe if I had a couple of hours, we'll sit down and explain it to you. But I believe that our minds are so screwed up, and we're such rationalizers, that we could tell our, read our whole four step to the ceiling, to God, and we still don't hear it. Somehow, some way, when I'm looking at another man in the eye and I'm humbling myself, you know, one of the things I see them do at meetings, and I don't believe in it. I'm just going to tell you, I don't believe in it. You know, I'm not saying it's good or bad, and somebody will say here, well, that's the way I did it. Is I believe that, look, I'm not a humble person. I don't know anything about humility. I'm not going to be able to give a talk on humility. I can give a talk on arrogance, but not humility. But I've been humbled. I know what it feels like to be humbled. I know that deal. I know what it feels like to be humbled. It's a good feeling, but it's horrible getting there. It's horrible getting there, I'll tell you that. And I know one thing, as it says in the big book, humility and the acquisition of humility has a lot to do with getting this thing. It says, how do we get a new attitude, a new perception, through 1,000 forms of humiliation and the crushing of our self-sufficiency? I know humiliation is it has something about sacrifice. You have to sacrifice something to get, this is a free gift, but there's some sacrifice involved. And the sacrifice is involved is giving away a piece of your ego, a piece of yourself. You know, it takes something. You may walk in here and you may have desperation. And you may want to stop drinking. And you may want that more than anything else. And you may have nothing to give this group. And somebody may hold up one of these white chips and say, anybody want a white chip? Come forward for the desire not to stop drinking. And you may walk from the back of the room to the front of the room to pick up this white chip. You know something? If you're an alcoholic, remember we were discussing about other people liking you and what do you think? That's a humbling experience. It's a humbling experience to walk from the back of the room to the front of the room. You know, when somebody does that, they may have nothing. They may have one half of nothing. They may have zero. But you want some, whatever they have, from walking from the back of the room to the front of the room, they've given everything they've got. So when you put this here, and you say, I'm going to leave it here so you can come back later on and sneak up and grab it, not in front of other people, just realize you're killing somebody. Just realize you're killing somebody. That you're not helping them at all. You're allowing them to slither up, grab this so nobody sees it, and they're not going to get a thing out of it. They're going to think they got something. They'll be able to say a rod chip or anything, but just realize you're hurting them. You're not helping them. Because if they can't walk from there to here to pick up a white chip, how are they going to do the four step? How are they going to do any of this stuff? It's all humbling. And somehow, when I look at another human being and I tell him what's going on and open up myself up for cross-examination and maybe a little questioning in a press conference, what do you mean you did this? What do you mean you did that? And somehow, that's a humbling experience. And not only does he hear it, but I hear it. And he hears it. And he puts value in it. And it starts working. So what do we do? So we try to avoid this deal. One of the reasons we avoid the fourth step is so we won't have to do the fifth step. Tell a little story, and then I'm going to end this by reading something at the end of the book. But I was, it's a true story. I was living in Long Island, Great Neck, and when you're 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, back then what was important was sports. How good you are in sports. I've never been good in sports. I've always been horrible at sports. And of course, I believe I was alcoholic long before I took my first drink because you know, alcoholism is something that happens. I was an alcoholic. I was waiting for alcohol to happen in my life, but the feelings I have about myself and other people and the fears predate my drinking alcohol. I mean, alcohol was the solution to my, the drinking of alcohol was the solution to my alcoholism. And after I stopped drinking, I still had the same thing I had before I started drinking. The same deal, the same emptiness, the same feeling separated from God, from other people, feeling alone. And loneliness is one of the symptoms that goes right along with that deal. That feeling of separation from God, that's the feeling of separation from others, that feeling like you won't understand, nobody will ever understand, you're just always alone and you can never connect. And you're always dry inside, and it's like no matter how much you drink, no matter how much you do, no matter how many people you know, no matter how many friends you have, I don't care how many friends you got on Facebook. It's always, then it's never enough. There ain't never enough. You know? Not enough friends on Facebook. Listen, there's not enough friends on Facebook to make you feel okay. Guys, there's not enough women you can have to make you okay. And girls, same thing. There's not another person can make you feel okay. As a matter of fact, if another person fixes you up, I feel real sorry for you. Okay. If you think booze is bad, being addicted to another person is even worse. And one day they're going to die or not be around, and then where are you going to be? You better be okay with you, or you can't be okay with anybody else. You know. So the bottom line is, I'm in New York, so they cared about sports. So what we used to do is we'd gather up at the baseball diamond, whether it was baseball, touch football, whatever it is, and we'd pick up teams. And you'd have two captains. And those, you know, the two captains are usually the guys who are the best guys, the best sports guys, you know what I mean? The best athletes. Which I got a kick out of one time I did this story, and a guy came up to me and he says, you know, I was one of the captains, so the captains are in here too. They didn't get away with this either. So we'd be in a group of about 20 guys, and they'd start picking, and one captain would say, and I was never the captain, of course, one guy, and I'm in the group. I'm in the middle of the group, and I'm like 10, 11 years old, and one guy says something like this. He says, well, I'll take Bob. And so what happens is Bob comes out of the group and goes over to that captain's side. You guys ever do this?
Yeah.
And then the other guy says, well, I'll take Fred. And Fred comes off, and so what's happening is the group is getting smaller, and I'm in the middle of the group. Now, what do you think I'm thinking? I'm praying. I swear, I'm praying. I'm saying, God, and I didn't even believe in God. I don't even think I believe. I don't know whether I believe. I say, God, please don't let me be last. I would be praying to be second to last. Second to last was, for me, second to last was like being picked first. I just didn't want to be the one they hated the most. And it seems to me, this may not be true. Like if I was picked second to last, there was one guy they hated more. It was like a bloody celebration for me. I was like the first round draft choice, you know what I mean? That happened once in a while, you know what I mean? But it seems to me like most of the time I was always picked last. And you know how kids pick people last? They say things like this. Oh, do we have to have them? It's like, they're cruel. Kids are cruel, you know? I mean, it's like in front of everybody. You're in front of a whole, do we have to have them? And they're laughing at you. Now I'm sitting there being laughed at with a bunch of guys. They're laughing at me. And you know what I'm thinking? You know, I'm telling you something. I know I'm not all powerful because they would have all been dead. They would have disintegrated. I would have disintegrated. I disappeared. So I'll tell you what I did. Obviously I didn't have the power because that. But I'll tell you what I did. What I did was this. I remember it like it was yesterday. And you know something? I would do the same thing today because I'm an alcoholic. This is the way alcoholics are. Because this has to do with alcoholism. I would act. I would put on an Oscar-winning act like it didn't bother me. As a matter of fact, they were laughing. I would laugh like they were laughing, like it was a big joke, like I was laughing at me, but I wasn't really me. I was like them. You know what I mean? I was laughing at me like they were laughing at me, like it didn't bother me, because somehow in my mind, if they didn't think that this bothered me and that I was laughing about it, they couldn't hurt me. Because I wasn't really me. I was like outside of me laughing at me. But if they knew they hurt me, I'd have to die and kill myself. So what I did was, this is what I did. I phonied up. To protect myself as a means of self-preservation, I acted on the outside exactly opposite to the way I felt on the inside. And you know, if you do that all your life, and you know what I found out? And I didn't even realize that. And I thought that thing that was protecting me from them was actually slowly over the years building up a wall that was 2, 3, 4 feet thick of concrete, which would never allow me to connect with another person because of fear of being hurt. And what I found was that natural instinct I had to act differently than what I felt and not tell you the truth about what's really going on inside of me was not something I did down in the baseball field. It's something I did in the state's attorney's office. It was something I did in the bar. It's something I did in a romantic relationship. It's something I did all over my life because it came natural to me. And so I found I was always acting. Whenever I was with you, I was showing you something different than what was going on inside. But here's the crazy thing. When you're always acting or portraying a role or acting differently than the way you actually feel, what happens is eventually you don't know how you feel. You start getting mixed up. You think you're actually feeling the way you're acting. You don't even understand how you're feeling. You're lost in space. And you can't even have an honest relationship with another human being, let alone yourself. Because you don't even know what the hell is going on in you. Because you've been acting, you've been John Wilkes Booth or Errol Flynn or Cary Grant or whoever you've been for so long. You have no idea what's going on. Until these walls are broken down and you start doing this. But the problem is I'm just as addicted to doing that as I was to drinking alcohol. Only I didn't even say I was doing that because I do that without even thinking. For 30 years. So how am I going to have a relationship with God when I don't even know who He is and I don't even know who I am and I can't even talk to Him like me because I don't know who me is. Page 75, returning home, we find the place after the fifth step where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. I'm sorry. You know I have an opinion on this. That's why they have chapter the agnostics. I don't know how you do this without God. I'm sorry, I'm not saying you can do anything. Hey, this is AA. All you need to get in here is the desire to stop drinking. But I'm reading this stuff. I just don't know how you do it. Honestly, if there's a program of honesty without God, without faith in God. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything. Omitted anything. I would say omitting God is like a big deal here. I mean, considering how much He's mentioned. For we are building, you ready? For we are building an arch through which we will shall at last walk a free man. There we are again. I mean, can it be any plainer? You really think this is like my opinion? This has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm like voicing just this is Russell's opinion. Well, that's Russell's opinion. That's not AA. I'll tell you what's really going around AA. What's going around AA is not AA. What you hear in the room is not AA. This is AA. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put in the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? So, you know, the bottom line is, the question really comes down, is like the first question you were asked when you come in here. It says, if you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. If you don't want what we have, then what do people have? They have the promises. They have that new freedom, that new. If you don't want that, you're not ready. You're just not going to. You're not ready. You could do it mechanically. You could do one of these things. Well, we're not going to let you out in treatment until you get a sponsor. We're not going to let you out in treatment. You can do it under a gun. You can do it. We won't let you out of jail until you do the four step. We won't let you out of jail until you do the. You can do it that way. You can do it under the gun and make believe and all that. And I'm not saying putting down anybody who's done it that way and it's worked. But the bottom line, eventually, somewhere along the line, you've got to want this deal. You got to want this deal. Now, I pray for everybody. You know, I just want to end this by saying this one thing. You know, I was talking about somebody. I could say it's an imaginary person, but it's like a lot of people I've ever known about people who get sidetracked. And they get focused on the things of the outside. You know, the glitter, the glamour, the bling stuff on the outside. We all get that way. We all do that. We all live in the real world. And they forget about what's really going on, what the real purpose is in here. The truth of the matter is, I don't think there's anybody immune to that. I mean, I've gone that deal. Everybody, no matter what's going on, you know, the bottom line is, everybody at every point in time, you know, until they drink, can always turn around. What I do know is I can't force somebody. What I do know, because I've tried it, is there's no amount of yelling, screaming, cajoling, persuasion, crying, whining, begging, that'll force somebody to want God in their life, want this freedom, want this fear removed until they get sick and tired and sick and tired and they get to the point where they just want to remove themselves. Hey, listen, what brought you in here? was because, well, I mean, we have different people that might have been brought in here by the court, but I mean, really, what brought you in here? Was it really because somebody gave you a good argument and you said, gee, I think you're right? Or was it, what stopped you from drinking? What made you finally admit that you were powerless over alcohol? Wasn't it because things got so bad and so unmanageable and your life so bad that you finally got to the point where you say, I need help, I can't stop drinking, I want to stop this, I want to get off this merry-go-round? Well, you know something? That should have told me, that should have been the first clue to tell me that that pattern is the way it works with all these deals. You know, even once the as the alcohol is removed, there's a part of my brain saying, okay, now that that's over, I want to rip, rate, and run and go back to business as usual. And so somehow, some way, as we walk into this thing, don't be surprised if you go through, don't be surprised if you go through a rough time when you're sober for a long period of time, longer than you think is necessary, and things aren't working out, and you're saying, why do I feel so bad? Why do I feel so horrible? Why, you know something? You don't drink long enough, and you feel horrible long enough, and you get desperate long enough, you will finally get to the point where you will say, and you may not have any idea, where you will say, I can't take anymore, I can't take feeling this way anymore, I don't want to feel this way anymore, and you will do that which you are supposed to do, which you haven't done in this deal. And when you look back, you'll say, hey, that's what they've been telling me to do all along. You will be forced by circumstances and by pain and by suffering to comply with this. This thing right here, he is not gonna change around and do gyrations to fit your schedule. This program and how he wants you to be is not gonna switch around and be flexible so he can make you happy according to your point of view. You're gonna somehow, some way, in the end, comply with this deal, or you're gonna drink, or you're just gonna stay sober and be miserable. And it ain't gonna work. It's gonna be real simple. It's like the cops say, you can do it the easy way or the hard way. You know, good cop, bad guy. It's going to be the easy way or the hard way. So God bless you. Thank you.